It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
On this edition of The Untold Story, I'm very pleased to be joined by David Sokol. David is the chairman and CEO of Teton Capital, chairman of the board at Atlas Corp, and former chairman and CEO of NetJets, also the author of his new book, America in Perspective, Defending the American Dream for the Next Generation, which was written alongside Adam Brandon. David, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Martha. I appreciate the opportunity to speak.
So you know, it's interesting. I was just speaking to someone who is at a CEO business roundtable today, and they are going to announce later that they have a very grim outlook about the next year in terms of the way that their businesses are likely to perform given the global environment that we live in. And basically the drivers of that are politics and energy security. Both of which, all of which, you know quite a bit about from all of your positions. And we now have yet another indicator that we are in an extraordinarily hot inflation environment. So what's your take on where we stand today, David?
Well, you know, first of all, I think the only people that seem to be surprised about where we are is the White House, the folks in the White House. You know, when you throw as much capital into the world economy and particularly to the U.S. economy that has been done necessary, I'm sure, in regard to COVID, but the last several trillion dollars, I think most would agree, was excessive and purely political. So on one hand, you throw that much new capital into the economy and you're going to overheat it. Secondly, there was a lot that took place that we probably still don't understand during that period of COVID with the lockdowns and that, where people were kind of forward spending, you know, doing as much as they could online, buying various things, et cetera, trying to offset the fact that they couldn't leave their house and that. When you get today, you know, inflation is definitely spiraling. Today's news or this morning, I think to most CEOs in business is not a surprise. And it was shocking to me to hear some of the president's advisors today saying we're not in a recession. They don't necessarily see anything other than a slight recession. I don't know a single CEO that doesn't think that effectively we're already in one, and that the next 12 to 18 months are going to be tough sledding economically. It's going to just take time for us to absorb the amount of excess capital in there, for the Federal Reserve to do the things it needs to do. And I think the biggest single thing that the White House could do is stop spending.
You know, it's interesting. Bill Hemmer and Dana Perino spoke with Jared Bernstein at the White House, and I've had the same impression in speaking with CEOs and talking to people in politics and listening to what's going on at the White House, that they seem to be on a different track in terms of their understanding of what's happening in the world. Here's what Bill Hemmer and Jared Bernstein spoke about earlier.
I wish we had better news. I'm certain that you wish this was better news. But at the heart of this is the core inflation number. And when it comes to core inflation, that does not include energy or food, but yet that number is the highest we've seen since 1982. Sir, is it time for this White House in the Biden administration to pivot on its economic policies?
No, I think what we have is the White House, the Federal Reserve. We are acutely aware of the pressures that this causes on American families and budgets. The president started out this morning by talking about how Americans are squeezed by the cost of living, and they didn't need this report to remind them of that, but that's certainly in the report.
Okay, just to be clear, I asked you that question, and you said no.
Let me explain why. Let me explain why. Because the policies that we're doing to help mitigate and ease price pressures are having effect.
What do you say to that?
To be honest, I think it's insanity, and it's shocking that any competent economist would even say what he just said. The problem today is really twofold. You've got the federal government throwing money into the economy for a whole lot of political reasons, for giving debt, infrastructure spending, which, by the way, at some point might make sense, not in the middle of an inflation cycle, and frankly, not overseen by folks that really don't know what they're doing in regard to spending that amount of money. But then on the other hand, you've got the government with a, in my view, an insane energy policy, really driven by the progressive left on the CO2 side. You know, there just is no plan behind their so-called energy policy. And when you take those two things, one of the biggest issues that we're seeing in industry is the cost of energy in every form, whether it's home heating oil, whether it's home electricity, or whether it's industrial use. You know, energy prices where they are, and they're probably going higher, don't need to be there. You know, America's producing 1.5 million barrels less oil today than the day that that President Biden took office. And that number is getting smaller, not larger. And there's no reason for that other than bad policy. So when you take excess spending and add to that, you know, the Federal Reserve is actually finally doing what it needs to do, which is raising short-term rates to slow the economy. But the insanity of this is it's like you have a fire and the Federal Reserve is trying to put the fire out by spraying water on it, and the White House is pouring gas on the other side. You can't spend money into an inflationary cycle and expect inflation to come down.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a have your cake and eat it too philosophy. When you keep pouring money into the U.S. economy, as you said, and then you're trying to essentially slow the whole engine down on the other side and cool it off, it doesn't tend to work. You know, I want to just step back for a moment, David. If you could give people who may not be familiar with your background, you know, your own personal background growing up in Nebraska in a large family, and, you know, how you became so successful.
Well, you know, thank you for that, Martha. It's got a little bit to do with why Adam and I decided to write the book. Both of us have a background. In my case, I came from rural Nebraska, lower income family with four brothers and sisters. And two terrific parents. And my dad preached to us, his parents were immigrants from Poland. And he preached to us that America is the land of opportunity, that the American dream is what you need to be thinking about. And he emphasized it. He never once tried to advise me what I should do, but he said, find what you want to do and chase it, because in this country, nobody gets in your way. And that was true. I graduated with an engineering degree, thinking I wanted to be an engineer, and a couple of years later pivoted to starting a business. And the reality is I thought there were more impediments in front of me than there actually were. I mean, I thought impediments like raising money and things of that nature. But, you know, when I started reaching out to people with my ideas and what we were going to try and develop, money was not an issue. If you have a good idea and you're willing to work hard and put yourself behind it, and money isn't what the American dream is really about. But for me, it worked out enormously well. And so the book, American Perspective, was really trying to get people back to realize that we're heading in a very dangerous direction with the government policies. And, you know, we're not an authoritarian government. The president of the United States does not have the right to just give away $500 billion in debt forgiveness for student loans. He responds to the Congress and to the Supreme Court of the United States, and they're nowhere in any law does the White House have that authority, and they know that. But we, the people, have to make sure they understand that, and we have to impress upon Congress that this is not acceptable. And that's really, you know, people need to remember, I guess, one thing, Martha, is that we're citizens, not subjects. You know, the subjects of Great Britain back in the 1700s is the whole reason our founding fathers wanted to have this revolutionary idea of a government by the people. And so that's my background and the whole reason for, you know, trying to make sure that this American dream is available to every young man and woman in the country going forward.
Can you talk about your time? Obviously, Warren Buffett's one of the most recognized names in investing in America. Can you talk a little bit about your time working alongside him?
Yeah, it was a fantastic period. We sold 80% of our company. It was then known Mid-American Energy Holdings Company. We sold 80% of it to Berkshire Hathaway in early 2000. And that gave me an opportunity to work under the tutelage of Mr. Buffett. You know, he provided enormous amounts of capital, which allowed us to grow that business. Put it in perspective, I think MidAmerican was roughly $5 billion in total assets in 2000. Today, it's over $100 billion in assets. One of the largest net earnings companies that Berkshire has, run by my partner, Greg Abel, who's a phenomenal executive. But that whole period, you know, you learned a lot about discipline from Mr. Buffett, looking for the long haul, you know, sustainable businesses, things of that nature. In that regard, his business capability is probably second to no one.
So the book that you've written, American Perspective, Defending the American Dream for the Next Generation, is something that the title reminds me of something I chat with my dad about a lot. My dad is 90 years old, and he often says that he doesn't know what has happened to this country and that he's very concerned. He has, you know, grandchildren and now three great-grandchildren as of this week. So he's very concerned about the direction of the country. Is there, and I think a lot of people are, and we could talk about a number of different categories that all of that falls into, whether it's education or patriotism or the way the economy works. But do you see that changing? Are you an optimist? And if so, what causes that change?
Yeah, I try to be an optimist in this regard because to me, if you look back over the last 240 plus years, what America has accomplished is extraordinary. You know, and anyone that looks at America in the proper perspective against anybody we compete against economically, art wise, philanthropy, less than 5% of the world's population today has the largest economy in the world, gives away more philanthropy globally than any other country in the world, has the highest GDP in the world, has the highest average income in the world. And for people to look at that and not recognize what has been accomplished, and that's been accomplished because of what the founding fathers set out, a consensus-based meritocracy of we the people. So my optimism comes from the fact that if we can get people to step back and look at why America is successful, we can always be better. I think the tradition of America is that we can always be better, and that's that self-healing nature that the founding fathers created in our Constitution. And if you look at the number of times that we've healed over the centuries, it's extraordinary. But we have to get people back to realize that the three parts of our government, the legislative, the administrative, and the judicial, must be kept separate. They must have the checks and balances we have. And unlike today, where, you know, the president a month or so back got bad news from the Supreme Court regarding an EPA initiative, where the court said the EPA does not have congressional authority to do what they're doing. That's all they said. They didn't say anything's good or bad about climate change or anything else. They just said you're trying to read something into a law from 1970 that doesn't exist. The president then came out and gave a speech in Massachusetts and said, well, Congress won't give me what I want on climate change, and the Supreme Court just turned down the EPA on this particular ruling, so I'm just going to do it by executive order. Well, that's not America. Nobody gave the president that right to do things that the Supreme Court says he doesn't have the right to do. And we've got to get back to recognize the importance of the Supreme Court's job as in checks and balances. But if we do that, I don't think anybody can stop America. But part of it, I think there's two major issues that have caused us to go where we've gone so far. One is we don't teach civics in American history adequately anymore in public schools around the country. So young people don't understand necessarily the difference between socialism and a representative republic like America. They don't understand that self-healing nature of America and the meritocracy benefits. They get focused, and today a lot of the press, likes to focus on separating us, turning us back into tribes. Well, America has always been known as the melting pot. No multicultural country like America has ever succeeded in the past. And today, if you look around, it's always amazing to me how quickly people criticize who we are. You know, I just read an article about that young woman that was arrested in Iran. and for not wearing a scarf, and then happened to die in jail several days later. Well, first of all, 22-year-olds don't happen to die that often accidentally. But also, who is she arrested by? I thought it was fascinating. They have in Iran what's known as the morality police. And now, again, no one's saying that we should be Iran for sure. But young people and frankly, all of us need to look at America in that perspective and say, what countries out there are the melting pot that America is? Where can you go from any society and be melted into the society like America? There's nowhere. And so I think we've got to get people to start realizing what we are and then recognize we can always be better. But this notion of lack of patriotism, kneeling for the national anthem, things of that nature, that's just disrespectful to the people who gave their lives to get us where we are. If you really feel strongly, then get out and do something about it. Kneeling isn't going to solve it.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
Kudlow on Fox Business is now on the go for podcast fans. Get key interviews with the biggest business newsmakers of the day. The Kudlow podcast will be available on the go after the show every weekday at foxbusinesspodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
So you said that your father taught you that in this country, no one gets in your way. Do you think that's still true, or is government getting in our way?
Well, you know, it's interesting. For the first 30 years of my career, I always felt that while I understood government's role, I always felt that they were in partnership with me, whether it was state or local government or federal, and that they wanted more economic growth. They wanted employment, and they wanted to see people get good opportunities, et cetera. They had to, do their role regulatorily, et cetera. In 2009, I had my first experience where things changed, and it came in a hearing where a congressman called me 2 days before a hearing. It was on a cap and trade bill for climate change. And he called me a couple of days before the hearing and threatened me not to attend and said, no one else is going to be testifying against this bill and we don't want you to. And I said, well, Congressman Markey, I said, I've already agreed to testify. I've already submitted my testimony. So I have to be there. And he said, well, there'll be hell to pay if you do. So I testified 2 days later, and at the end of my testimony, when the committee took a break, I was approached as I was leaving with all these reporters, and they weren't asking me about my testimony. They were asking me, what is your reaction to Congressman Markey requesting an investigation into you and Mr. Buffett for price fixing? I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And while I was testifying, he had his staff file a complaint with FERC to look into Mr. Buffett and I for price fixing. Now, the absurdity of that is MidAmerican Energy owns regulated utilities. We don't set the prices. The regulatory bodies in each state set the prices. And so it was such a ridiculous thing for him to do because it was so obviously nothing but trying to punish us. Yeah. For speaking up. And by the way, that bill would have been a disaster. It was poorly written. It wouldn't have worked, and it would have almost doubled consumer energy bills. But from that point forward is when I realized that government now is no longer on my side. They now want to control what you do, and that's not America. And we need to get that out of the system.
Did that affect your political alliance? I mean, have you always been conservative, or when you were younger, how do you line up, and has it changed over your lifetime?
Well, my father was a Democrat, and I understood, and this is, my father passed away in 94. So this is prior to 94. He was a World War II Marine veteran.
Where did he serve?
In Europe. But his views were more that party looked out for the little guy. But he was a conservative person from a financial perspective. I couldn't tell you whether he was socially conservative or liberal because he didn't think it was any of his business. It was kind of, that's none of my business. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what he liked about America is that our government stayed out of our business that they didn't know about, didn't need to know about. But in any event, I've always been more conservative, probably because I would, from his teaching of being conservative from a financial perspective and things of that nature. And one of the things that he did always teach us as kids was to be more conservative about things doesn't mean you want to stop things. It means that you want people to think about them. Because once society changes, it's very hard to ever go backwards. Mm. And so to him, conservatism wasn't necessarily a financial or a social thing. It was just take your time, because he always had a phrase, dinner is never eaten as hot as it's cooked. And so there'd be a lot of excitement sometimes about an idea. But then when people really think it through, they realize there's problems with it. And so that's where and I think that just followed, with me in business and that. So, but boy, I'll tell you, I definitely would never vote for Congressman and now Senator Markey, because I don't think it's their place to try and intimidate witnesses.
That's a very interesting story. You touched on education a moment ago, and I'm curious what you think the solution for that is, because it is appalling what a poor job we're doing in terms of educating kids about sort of things that we would consider the basics. You just mentioned World War II, where your father served, Korea, Vietnam, the Civil War. I don't think that schools are doing a good job teaching the basics of American history. How would you change that? What's the solution?
Well, I think there's two things we have to do. We've got to get parents back involved at the local school level. And I think people are realizing that. And I think that's absolutely critical. The second thing we need to do is get curriculums back to the basics. Reading, writing, arithmetic, American history. Those are the fundamentals that people have to have. And we need to get away from, an example would be a young lady that I met the other day. She's actually from Venezuela. But has moved here. She's actually a lawyer, and she's moved to the U.S. because of the disaster in Venezuela. And one of the things she said she was shocked at is that children here do not have to, when they start grade school, they don't have to speak English. And she just thinks that's horrible. Mm-hmm. And that pushed me back to thinking about something my father, when I was young, I asked him, how much Polish does he speak? And he said, none. They said, because his parents refused to teach him Polish, because they said, you're American now. You can be proud of being Polish as your history and from where your family came from. But the Polish language will do you no good in this country. And now that's not to say, that people can't be bilingual. But I think that's an example, though, if we're asking children, immigrant children to learn things, we're putting them behind by not giving them English as a first language. And certainly they can maintain Hispanic or any other or Spanish or any other language they want. So I think getting back to the basics and getting parents involved is critical. And I think this whole notion of the government, considering parents terrorists if they have ideas at school board meetings is ridiculous. And it's frankly, sounds more like Nazi Germany than it sounds like America. The other thing is, and I hate to say this, but I think it's true. I think we have to find a way to break up these national teachers unions. The prior president of the teachers union was quoted one time in a testimony when asked why they weren't looking out for children more. And his comment was, when children start paying dues to my union, we'll look out for them. And that should be a loud message to parents. There is nobody looking out for the kids other than the kids. And I don't mean that teachers aren't good people. I have two nieces that were teachers. But if the unions aren't letting them teach properly, and what you're seeing in the public school system since these unions have become so powerful is this acceleration of administrative growth. In many public school systems now, you have as many administrators as you do teachers. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. I'm just struck by something that has been a big subject for me and for our program is the learning loss that was suffered during COVID. And I don't understand why there isn't a nationwide program to catch kids up. And we hear absolutely nothing about it at the federal level. I'm astonished that we've had this 2-year pandemic and kids were in and out of schools and we know how much they suffered from it. And yet the Department of Education doesn't have any comprehensive nationwide program. They gave out $27 million, I think, for summer programs, and then said that they didn't really know for sure how the different districts might have used that money. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, this administration, and it's not the first that's felt this way, things are all about politics, not about really solving problems. And I think this is one that is just, it's horrible, because when you set a child behind, and a lot of these, you know, lower income children are behind for a lot of reasons. And by the way, most of those reasons have nothing to do, they're not their fault. And for us not to actually look at these statistics and take them seriously, and maybe have 2 years of summer school added to the programs or something to let these young people catch up, because, you know, just talking about it. And that's the problem, to be honest, that I have with this administration and some prior administrations. And climate change is a great example. You know, if in fact climate change is the existential threat of our planet, then let's develop a consensus amongst people as to how to approach it. And if it is such an existential threat, how come we can't get China and India and other countries to sign up with us? Because if we do it alone, all we do is bankrupt America, and we don't do anything for climate change. All these piecemeal things like building charging stations for cars and that, you know, frankly, here's a simple reality. If environmentalists truly cared about solving this problem, or progressives or the Democratic Party, they should be out promoting hybrid cars, because they're by far the most environmentally sensitive today. Not fully electric, but hybrids. And yet they don't even talk about them. Everything's a soundbite. Everything's about political advantage. But, you know, energy is the lifeblood of every economy. And if we're just going to change it without thinking about it, we're going to make a hell of a mess. And we're already doing it. You know, you need a glide slope to come off fossil fuels over the next 50 years. And you have to have things that will pick up the pieces in between, because poor people and even middle income people, they can't afford the kind of energy bills that they're going to be getting. And they're being misled into this notion that electricity will be free in the future when you buy a car that's all electric and things of that nature. That's all nonsense. I mean, it's going to cost trillions of dollars to replace our grid system from a generation perspective, and to expand the grid system to be able to handle all electric industries as well as vehicles. There's no planning whatsoever for that. So, and again, that, you know, whether it's education, whether it's major policies, you know, it's all sound bites today and no real substance. But boy, I'll tell you what, people are going to pay a huge price for the lack of planning and the lack of getting the globe together on CO2, or the lack of actually dealing with poor children's education. If we spend less time arguing about trying to socially manipulate grade school kids and actually teaching them reading, writing, and arithmetic, we would do them a much bigger favor.
Yeah. We need to prepare our children to be competitive in the world. And the only way to do that is to make sure that they are, you know, meeting the goals of learning in grade school, and then in middle school, and then in high school, so that they are truly prepared. And we spend a lot of time talking to them about things that are not related to those basics. And my feeling is that, you know, once you've hit it out of the park and we're number one in math and reading and science, then you can start to say, you know what, maybe we can spend 15 minutes a day, you know, talking about some other issues. But until you've achieved that goal, it seems to me you haven't done your job. Before I let you go, what are your thoughts on the presidential race in 2024?
Well, in a nutshell, we need a new president. I just hope that it's going to be a new name. When I say new, somebody who hasn't been president or isn't a legacy of someone who has. You know, we need we need to get back to the basics. We need real leadership. We need a Ronald Reagan type of person who's going to set a set of goals that brings the country together, and then is going to actually bring people onto their cabinet that are talented and capable to actually execute that. And you know, today, I mean, if I was probably going to support someone today, it would be Ron DeSantis. I've watched what he's done down in Florida. and very impressive. And I didn't know who he was before he became governor. But I'll tell you, I was incredibly impressed with his rational approach to the COVID situation, recognizing the state's not all the same and dealing with it county by county, things of that nature. He talked to the people. We need that kind of leadership going forward. I think, unfortunately, you know, Mr. Trump, he raised a lot of issues, and I probably agreed with a large portion of his policies. But we need someone else to carry that message going forward. We really do. And age matters. You know, it doesn't. I'm not saying that people can't be incredibly talented into their 80s and 90s. But being president of the United States is a wearing job. We're seeing the mistake that can be made by electing someone for the wrong reasons and ignoring, you know, an obvious defect. And that's a mistake going forward. We really, the country is going to make some enormous blunders if we're not careful. And so leadership is going to be critical.
Are you interested in politics or running for office?
No, I'm too old. But I'm definitely interested in politics because leadership does matter so much. You know, that's something I think people are losing sight of in our country, is that who we elect really does matter. There are representatives.
David Sokol, thank you very much for speaking with me today for The Untold Story. The new book is called America in Perspective, Defending the American Dream for the Next Generation. And I thank you for talking with me.
Well, my pleasure, Martha, and thanks for what you do.
You've been listening to The Untold Story. I'm Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.